the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, Americans are living longer with advances in medical technology and vast improvements in people's lifestyles and supplements and dietary changes. The life expectancy for a man right now is 78.8 years, for women, 81.2, which I maintain is not fair, but that's the way it is. Okay. Note, however, by the way, life expectancies here in the United States have fallen since 2011. If you compare it to the U.S., which was, we'll say, 78 years approximately for men, U.K., it's 81.6, and Japan, 84. And a lot of that, by the way, the differences between our country and those countries is the American diet. Now, one of the consequences of living into your 70s and 80s is the likelihood of needing long-term care, which can seriously be devastating financially due to the high cost. And so the probabilities go up the older you get. Tomorrow on the program, by the way, Jim's guest is going to be Dr. Michael Greger, and he's going to deal with this. His new book is How Not to Die, and he talks about the role that diet plays in longevity. But either way, people may require long-term care, and that's what we want to deal with here on the program today.
You know what kind of prompted this was a number of clients who have recently gotten into medical difficulties, but also, John, in the recent cover issue of Barron's, the title was How to Curb the High Cost of Caregiving. And so it really grabbed my attention, especially since what we've seen in our own practice. And the thing that really hit us is recently we've lost a couple clients, and in my own case, with my mother's passing last year. And so, you know, dealing with these issues, which eventually crop up for just about every single family. Now, the one thing that caught my attention with Barron's is they noted the cost of care could be running as high as $98,000 a year. And certainly if you live in California in a full-time care facility with, let's say, a husband and wife, that is certainly not out of line. And here's the other thing. The average stay in one of these nursing homes is 2 years. But remember, that's an average. That's combined with people that may live 3, 4, 5 years in a facility and people that may only live 6 months to a year. And so if you take that average cost and multiply it by 2 years, that's $200,000. That's a lot of money. So providing long-term care can be one of the biggest challenges of aging. And there is no perfect template in terms of how to meet that challenge. You can't say, all right, if you do this, it's all solved. Everybody's going to be a little bit different, either health-wise, longevity-wise on either side. And then also in terms of where you live may also determine what you end up spending. But there's a lot of misconceptions out there. Genworth Financial, which is one of the few companies left that is writing long-term care policies, did a survey. And here's the interesting thing about that survey is 2/3 of the individuals in the survey mistakenly thought that long-term care was covered by Medicare, which it is not. And so a lot of reasons why people don't plan for it. Number one, they're not cognizant of it. Number two, they may not be thinking, you retire, you're in pretty good health, and you're thinking, you know, I've got another 20, 25 years. That's something I deal with later on. The third one is it's just something that all of a sudden comes at you in a surprise. Something happens. You have a fall. You have a stroke. And so this is something that is not really planned for in most people's retirement. And you're dealing with medical expenses. You're on Medicare. You have your Medicare supplement. But the long-term care issue is the big one, and that's the one that can hit you later on in life. And especially if you have not prepared for it, put money aside in your budget every single year to deal with it. That's what I call the gotcha. And it's one of the reasons why when they say a lot of people die broke or end up with their kids, this is one reason why. And remember when they talk about this study, and they talk about, you know, the average cost, 2 years, maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars. Remember, these are just average cost. And that's why you really can't go with the averages. You know, just take a look at your own family history. Maybe you had a grandparent. Maybe you had your own parents that were in a long-term care facility. And, you know, just look at what you had to deal with, what the costs were. And so what I found fascinating, and I think this will be very helpful for many of you that may end up dealing with an issue like this, is the Barron's article recommended the solution. And they basically talked about there's different phases in terms of what we call caregiving. And they also said that, you know, you really should, before you ever get to that point, or maybe that issue is right in front of you right now that you're having to face and deal with, is talk to lawyers, insurance experts, advisors, caretaker specialists beforehand, so that if something like this does crop up or occur, you know exactly what you have to do, and you're not caught in a panic and saying, oh my God, what do we do now? We weren't thinking of this. And I've seen this over and over again, a lot of times with clients where they just, you know, all of a sudden they're thrust into a situation where they're having to deal with this with either an ill spouse, you know, maybe one spouse gets a stroke, is incapacitated, and this happens especially with older folks as they get into their late 80s and 90s and have a fall. And all of a sudden now you're dealing with deteriorating medical conditions. It's one of the reasons why we're going to be covering yoga here in the future, because one of the issues that you deal with as you age is balance, and learning to balance yourself or catch yourself when you fall. And this is one of the things that yoga has been proven to be very, very helpful in terms of handling those kind of issues. And also, by the way, of dealing with or preventing arthritis as you get older. But let's get to the Barron's article, because what they did, and they broke down caregiving in three phases, and we're going to take each one of these. And if you think about it, there's different phases that progress when somebody has a disease, whether they have dementia, they have Alzheimer's, or just simply they're getting older and they're more feeble. Maybe they're not as ambulatory when they're younger.
You know, one of the things we did find out from taking care of my mother for a long period of time, and that was people tend to go downhill in quantum steps. They don't just sort of slide. One day everything's okay, and then ba-doom, something happens, and you're down a step, and you never get back to the step that you were on before. It's very strange. You know, you would think, well, this is a gradual thing, and it doesn't tend to be. And that's usually step one in this whole process, where all of a sudden something happens. The person doesn't find their way home. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that's why Barron's broke this up in the first phase. And I know, just like your mother, we experienced this with my own mother, who had a stroke and was basically, John, given 3 months to live. They put her into hospice when she wasn't doing well in rehab. And they said she'll either be gone in 3 months or she'll be a hospice graduate. Well, she turned out to be a hospice graduate and lived 30 months afterwards. But in the final phase, just like with your own mother, the situation deteriorates. And that's why I thought the Barron's article talking about the three different phases was so appropriate. So let's talk about the first phase. The first phase is something comes up. Maybe you're noticing with an elder parent that there's something that's changing. I know in my own mother's case, we came from a large family, and one of her favorite things to do was to go and have dinner with her kids. And the first time the problem surfaced is she got lost driving at night, trying to find her way home. After that happened two or three times, one of my sisters took her to have a medical checkup. And when they did the test, they found out she had the beginning signs of dementia. So in the first phase, it's usually a person starts to develop in some way or another medical difficulties. In caregiving at this stage resembles really more of kind of a lending hand. So in my mother's case, where she had difficulty at night, my sisters or my brothers would say, Mom, why don't we come over and we'll pick you up, bring you over to the house for dinner, and then we'll take you home. Or it's something like simple errands around the house. The bulk of long-term care or any kind of care in this first phase is usually handled by family members. as I mentioned in my mother's case, my sister's picking her up and bringing her over for dinner, trips, maybe taking the individual to the doctor's office, house cleaning, aiding with some menial tasks, doing errands for that person. But at this point, usually it's the family that gets together and begins to deal with the issue. And between the family members, it's really important and say, all right, who's going to do this for mom or dad, whatever the case might be? Two or three of my family members live very close to each other. There was one sister that volunteered and said, you know what? I'll pick up mom when she wants to go to dinner. I had another sister who would take my mom to the doctor because she had a difficult time getting on the freeways and negotiating driving on a freeway. So usually at this stage, it is family members that are getting involved, and it's good to know beforehand, should something come up, what family members are going to do what and how you're going to deal with the situation. You need to consider at this point when you have two spouses living, where at this point you have one that's becoming disabled, incapacitated, suffers a stroke or has something that happens, you also need to deal with what's going to happen with the surviving spouse. And it's not just medical issues. It's financial issues. I recently had a client who lost her husband. This was his second marriage, her second marriage. And in this case, when my client, the husband, he had been divorced. So when it came time to retire and take his pension from the company, he took his pension, which was a higher benefit based on his life because he was divorced. In the settlement, his pension belonged to him. And he was thinking, I'm not going to get married again. And then, of course, he met his second wife, fell in love, and they were married for almost 25 years. But unfortunately, when he passed away, gone was the pension. And it was not just the pension was gone, but also, as many of you are aware, between husband and wife, when one spouse passes away, usually it's the husband, the surviving spouse, the wife, has the option of taking the larger Social Security benefit, in this case, the husband. But at the same time, she loses her own Social Security. So in this case, with this client, not only did she lose her husband's pension from a major corporation, that was back in the days he was fortunate enough when they had defined benefit pension plans, but she also lost her own Social Security, exchanging hers for her deceased husband's. And that ended up being a loss of nearly $2,500 a month. I mean, that's $30,000 a year. And so it's very important when you're thinking and planning about this is what happens when one spouse passes away or one spouse becomes seriously ill and requires, let's say, assisted living. And now you're maintaining two households, one for the well spouse and one for the one that is sick. And so in this case, the option is going to be we're going to have to tap into the equity in the home and we're going to have to downsize the house and free up some equity because there simply isn't enough assets to make up the $30,000 loss in income. Just to give you an idea, you take safe investment returns, let's say today 3%, if you're looking at 10-year treasury notes or safe corporate bonds, to replace that $30,000 would almost require $1 million of capital. So you can see how planning for this kind of event in advance is very, very important because you don't want to be caught in surprise in this kind of situation. You also see couples, for example, that may end up moving into an assisted care facility. And we had a client that moved into a 2-bedroom assisted care facility. However, when his wife passed away, what did he lose? He lost her Social Security check. And in this case, we had to redo his financial plan. And we basically had to say, you know, you can't afford to stay in this 2-bedroom apartment. You don't have enough money. You just lost this income. And so in this case, he had to move to a smaller facility in a 1-bedroom. So there was an adjustment that was made. So when you look at these situations on care, You have to approach it from two points of view. The human aspect, who takes care, what happens to the well spouse, and also the financial resources that may be required, or in cases of loss of a spouse, may be lost as a result of death. And that's where I think it's very important that you talk to your advisor, your doctor. For example, in this first phase, there are a lot of faith-based community resources that can assist you with, for example, transportation. And also, you might want to think early on, especially if this is run in the family where you have, let's say, older parents that lived into their 90s, the situation I just mentioned where she just lost her husband, her own mother lived to the age of 99. And one of the things that we had to explain to her, you know, she couldn't afford to live in a house with that much equity because losing $30,000 of income is a major setback in terms of lifestyle. Now, fortunate for this couple, they lived basically off their Social Security and his corporate pension plan and really weren't touching their investments other than mandatory withdrawals from an IRA. But now we're going to have to make up that $30,000 difference. So we're going to need a lot of that equity, which means downsizing in a home. And this is something, it's, you know, wasn't very pleasant because you get used to living in a place. Nobody wants to move once you get settled, and especially as you age and you live in a community where you know everybody, your friends, you know, your country club, and your whole social life is built around this area that you live, and all of a sudden you're going to have to be uprooted. So that is something you usually deal in the first phase. The medical issues aren't really big at this point, but as you know, John, as you were mentioning, and I've seen this in the care of my own mother before she passed on, and of course your mother, it develops in phases. And as the phases develop, the care, the expenses, all of that changes dramatically.
Now, the Barron's article talked about seven phases of basically transitions when you're dealing with this. I'm going to guess that phase two would be where medical conditions worsen. That requires a change of strategy, whether the person can be left alone or not, and change of medical care as well.
That's exactly what usually happens. Usually somebody has a stroke, or let's say they're in their late 80s and 90s, they have a fall, and all of a sudden their movements become restricted. I know, like, my mother was diagnosed with dementia, but then when she had her stroke and had a fall as a result of the stroke, it accelerated not only the care, but also the financial resources that were going to be needed to take care of the situation. And usually a lot of this is usually suddenly, it's an occurrence. In the case of my mother, she had a stroke. And when she had that stroke, she fell. And you see this so often where a person falls, they injure themselves. And this is one of the reasons I'm going to talk in the future with some guests on how you can use yoga to maintain your balance as you age, which is so critical when you start getting into your 80s and 90s to avoid, let's say, a serious fall. And the risk is you could end up going into the hospital, you have a stroke, and you can go back into the hospital. I know in my own family situation with my mother, there were like 8 or 9 times where she ended up going back into the hospital, either a mini stroke, a UTI infection. All these things begin to accelerate in phase two. And when you're in the hospital, Medicare pays 100% of the first 20 days. And then after that, it's $167.50. And then it escalates to the point where it isn't covered. And this is why a lot of people think, because Medicare covers the first 20 days, that, hey, you go into a long-term care facility, Medicare takes care of it. That's not the case. If you end up getting to diminish all your assets, you may get into a situation where Medicaid ends up taking those expenses, but you're going to run through your assets before you do it. Sometimes there's a way to do that where you can get into an annuity program. The problem that surfaces in phase two is the harsh reality begins to set in. And this may be the stage where family members usually begin to step in and provide care. And usually it's going to be the female members of the family, because 2/3 of caregivers are women, as well as almost 85% of survivors in Social Security are also women. And sometimes you'll see caregivers leave the workforce, or let's say they reduce their working hours, which does a number of things for them. It affects not only their income and their career trajectory, but also their future Social Security benefits. A lot of times, in many cases where we've come across this with their own clients, we recommended the family member keep the job, even though the earnings would go towards hired care, because we didn't want that particular spouse to lose out on Social Security benefits by being absent from the workforce, and especially women that have a career where they could advance. So there's a lot of other options to consider. And one of them is to find a geriatric care manager that kind of help you navigate the labyrinth of all the government rules, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, insurance, long-term care. And the other thing is also finding a qualified caregiver, somebody that knows about medication, that is, you know, has a bit of a medical background. It's not just taking care of the individual. It's all some of the tasks that need to be done around the house. And it may be at this point where, let's say you have a surviving spouse, where you have to take a look at the option of either a reverse mortgage or actually putting the house up for sale and putting the unwell survivor into a long-term care facility. But in phase two, the medical conditions are more pronounced, they're more serious, they're going to require more care and more financial wherewithal to handle those additional expenses.
If we enter phase three now, that's the critical phase, and that's where the medical condition deteriorates on an accelerated basis, and it usually means full-time care. You just can't have someone coming in periodically, a daily checkup, or anything related to that.
Yeah, this is the more intense phase because the level of care goes up, the cognitive decline begins to accelerate, the unwell individual may be bedridden. At this point, assisted living is probably the only viable option. And this is where expenses begin to jump. You may be forced in this situation to sell a home, or if you're eventually moving towards Medicaid because there's just not going to be the assets there, you might want to take a look and explore at the immediate annuity option, especially if you're trying to preserve some assets for inheritance. And then you also might want to take a look at taking a look into hospice care. A number of things that are out there and some options we're going to discuss here in just a moment is we have one client right now where we're tapping into a paid-up life insurance that had a lot of cash value. So the life insurance company knows that they're going to end up paying on that policy. Some of these policies have what is called a living benefit. So instead of paying out the benefit at death, you can sort of receive an annuity payment until you use up the life benefit. But all of a sudden, you can tap into that life insurance. And by the way, that is considered tax-free. So this is an option that also you look at. But when you take a look at these different phases, and for married couples, here's one you really have to think about. The greatest risk is when both of you are well and living, because all of a sudden one spouse gets seriously ill, has to have special care, maybe have to go into either assisted living or care in the home, intermediate care of some sort. All of a sudden, now you have not only added expenses, but you could be, in some cases, where you're maintaining two different households, and those expenses can really escalate and cover you. Now, you know, when you get down to spending assets, you know, you can take a look at the Medicaid option, which will come into play. But, you know, when you get into Medicaid, there is just all kinds of rules, and you really have to spend down a lot of your assets. Certain rules, such as you may have a small life insurance policy, a home, an automobile, are exempt from a spend down provision as long as the patient intends to return home or one spouse remains in the house. But there's all kinds of rules here that we don't have time to get into, but that is an option. So there are a number of things you should think about this when you're getting ready to retire, and especially any of you that have gone through this, either with a grandparent, an aunt, or your own parents, you should incorporate that into your own planning.
Well, given the fact that the medical condition of an unwell spouse develops over time, from minimal care to around the clock, what kind of a checklist do you have of things that need to be done at each period here so that you're prepared for the next stage?
Well, why don't we talk about the financial options? Because it's not just a human issue, it's also financial. You know, obviously the ideal situation, if you're young enough, well enough, is to get a long-term care policy because you have an insurance coverage for that. Secondly, is to take a look at annuities, immediate annuities, or, for example, having an annuity on each one of you. So like, let's say there's an annuity policy investment that's taken on the husband, one on the wife, naming each other as beneficiary if you never end up using it. Let's just take the husband. He has a policy, wife has a policy. The annuity is accumulating, it's growing. All of a sudden, husband passes away. He didn't use the annuity option. That annuity goes to the wife as a survivor. So annuities is an option. If you are fortunate enough to have enough money where you're not tapping into your assets, then self-funding also becomes an option. Retirement homes where you go in, depending on what kind of home, there's all kinds of programs out there where you actually own the home or you put a down payment. And what happens, both husband and wife are living in their apartment. One of them becomes ill. They can go over to the other side of the retirement home where they have a facility to take care of the unwell spouse. So if you have enough bucks, because these can cost $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month, they're not cheap. But if you have the money, that's another option. Reverse mortgages when you're staying in the house is another option you can tap into if such a situation arises. Health savings accounts that you take out, let's say during your working career, and you set some money aside, and then of course exhausting your assets and then taking a look at the Medicaid option. So, you know, the thing that you have to think about, and this is why it's so important to plan, there's six or seven different options you have to consider if such an event arrives between either spouse or with your parents.
So here's our summary checklist. You have to have a plan. That's number one. We always say that. Don't get caught by surprise, because if you live long enough, the odds are something is going to happen to you or your spouse or other family member. Number two, even if you do have a plan, then have a backup plan. Panic is not considered a good option, by the way, in there. Number three, when you're planning for retirement, make sure medical costs and long-term costs are budgeted in, because sooner or later you may need them. Number four, have a trust and medical directives already done. This is really important both during the spouse's life and after death, because it makes things go a lot more easily. Number five, discuss care or options or what you have done with your kids. So if something happens to you, the kids aren't going, oh my gosh, what do we do now? What did mom or dad do? Did they have anything? You know, that type of stuff. So they understand. Number six, look at alternative housing. If you have to downsize, again, moving might be a possibility. You want to free up capital in this case. Number seven, always update your retirement plan throughout your retirement, because as we've talked about before on other programs, bear markets can change your income flow. And this is very important to recognize. So that's our checklist for that. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Dr. Michael Greger, How Not to Die. He's talking about diet here, plant-based diets as being important for longevity. All right, Jim, time for our real life case study, which is a hypothetical illustration based on real life examples. Names and circumstances have been changed, and we always have slides online at financialsense.com to illustrate the points being made. So take it away.
You know, John, I wanted to make a comment about having medical directives and successor medical directives. We were just brought a case by the kids of a client who just passed away. It was the father, and the mom had Alzheimer's. So in their estate plan, they had a trust, which was a good thing, but the medical directives was the wife, because the husband had a disability. He was in a wheelchair, and it was just assumed he would go first, which is exactly what happened. What was not taken into consideration in their estate plan, what would happen if, let's say, the wife was incapacitated. And in this case, that's exactly the case. She had Alzheimer's, so it created a difficulty. So this is why, you know, when we say not just have a plan, but also have a backup plan, plan B, if things don't go as anticipated. Well, let's take a look at this week's case study. This week, we're going to call this the case of Cindy Ross. She's age 75. She's retired, and her life expectancy is expected to be close to age 90, about 88. And once again, we see this so often. Women end up being the caregivers. Women end up being the survivors. It's just statistically the way we're built. The guys go first. Her investment objectives, capital and income preservation. And Cindy has been retired for about 10 years. She lost her spouse about a year ago due to a heart condition. She has immersed herself into artwork, but has been having difficulty. So she saw a doctor and was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Now, she decided to seek help given all the major life events she was going through in such a short period of time. And you can imagine what happens when all of this is thrust upon you and something suddenly changes in a marriage or your life. Cindy acknowledges she will most likely need help at some point, but she doesn't want to have to rely on the kids and be a burden to them. Rather, she would prefer to maintain her independence for as long as possible. Now, her kids live in Tennessee in South Carolina, while her and her late husband lived in California for most of their marriage. She would like to be able to leave some sort of legacy for her children. What was important to Cindy is not having to rely on her kids to take care of her, managing medical cost, and then the cost when it comes to her lifestyle, maintaining her independence was very important to her, and leaving a legacy to her children. Her essential budget was $51,000. Discretionary was about $17,000. That included basically golf and cruises that she would take with her friends. Social Security was $24,000, leaving a shortfall of $41,000. And basically, her essential budget was about $53,000. Social Security covered about $24,000. And so that left her with about $29,000 shortfall. Her primary residence was basically almost free and clear. There was a small mortgage left on it, about $80,000. Cindy's retirement assets, $470,000. She had taxable accounts of almost $600,000. And she had cash and some precious metals, which was basically her husband. He bought gold eagles is what he bought. It was about $175,000. So total investment assets were roughly about $1.25 million. Now, basically what we did is took a look at relocating to South Carolina, because that's where most of her kids are. Her retirement assets, everything, we would have about $1.25 million. That would increase somewhat because as a result of selling her house here in California and relocating to another state where the cost of living would be cheaper. So part of the issues were managing potential cost associated with long-term care, because remember, she wanted to maintain her lifestyle and flexible enough to meet her needs. And of course, with her assets, she wanted to leave something to her two children. So what we did is we set up a balanced account that produced income of roughly about $41,000, almost $42,000 with Social Security. Her income was about $65,000 less a budget of $53,000. That left a surplus of about $13,000 a year. Now, moving closer to her children in South Carolina, she still wanted to be close to the ocean with her relocating to another state, and especially with a nice coastline. A new home would allow her much more independence, but she was going to downsize to a smaller house, the house here in California being much larger. By having her relocate and downsize, this would lower her living expenses, which allow her to afford the possibility of using in-home care. And that's really what her desire was. She wanted to stay in her house. She wanted to have that independence, and she didn't want to have to become a burden to her children. The sale of the California house would provide her with a couple extra $100,000 compared to what she was going to have to get for a home in South Carolina, which would be obviously cheaper than any place here in California. And these increased the chances that she could maintain her independent lifestyle and be independent and not have to rely on her children. So in this case, John, it was downsizing, taking a lot of that equity that was in the house, downsizing to another home that would be smaller, less costly, easier to maintain, and also relocating to where her kids were, because, you know, they could do some of the things that we talked about in phase one in today's program. Maybe on transportation, take mom to the doctor, or maybe do some errands and help mom around. But so this case, actually downsizing, freeing up capital, and getting herself in a house that was more suitable to a surviving spouse and in-house care. In other words, there would be another bedroom in case she needed in-house care.
And coming up again tomorrow on the program, Dr. Michael Greger, How Not to Die, with the factor of diet in not dying. So that should be an interesting conversation. Weeks to come, what are we looking forward to, Jim?
There's a couple things I want to handle. I've gotten involved really with yoga recently, and I've taken that up as a result of not only people we've interviewed here on the program, but also reading books on health and how this can be used to either manage blood pressure, balance, and keep yourself more flexible. We'll be looking at that. We're going to also be looking at this tax law change because we're still finding out little by little. And believe it or not, John, I don't know if they ever get this far in the election year. They're talking about phase two of tax cuts, either making the tax cuts in place permanent, which they would take a majority to do that, but other things as well. And a lot of individuals, maybe you haven't been told by your CPA or accountant yet, when you're filing your 2017 tax return, a lot of these things go into effect this year. You might be losing mortgage deductions. You might be losing part of your property tax deductions. Certain things aren't deductible anymore, and you're losing your state income tax deductions. So there are a lot of things that are going into play, and especially in terms of capital gains and dividend income, that is a lot more favorable for a retired couple today. So we're going to talk about ways to minimize taxes as well as we get closer to that April 15th deadline. So all of that and more coming up in the weeks ahead. Hope you'll be here to join us on that. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.